We will hear argument next in Merck Sharp and Dohme Corp against Amneal Pharmaceuticals, number 17-1560. Mr. Barzoukas.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Nicholas Barzoukas with co-counsel Lisa Thomas on behalf of Merck & Company. This is a case that we believe presents a very important issue with respect to Hatch-Waxman cases. And it's an issue that can affect a particular...
It would help me a lot if you could, in extremely short order, forget for a minute the legal questions and go date by date with the batches that are at issue, say what they were, what happened between them, starting a little bit with the exhibit and batches and the commercial batches, but mostly focusing on what started happening in January of, was it 2016?
Absolutely.
Because it's more than a little bit confusing.
So to kind of start the history, obviously Amneal filed an ANDA to make a generic version of the drug Nasonex containing mometasone furoate. It originally filed its ANDA, and with that ANDA, it submitted, among other things, the three exhibit batches that are talked about in this case. Those are the three exhibit batches. Those were completed, I believe, sometime in 2013, a long time ago. At the time, that was a different ANDA because this same ANDA was amended in 2016. Now, Amneal submitted those exhibit batches back in 2013. Eventually, it got a complete ANDA on file. Merck received notification of this, and we filed the Hatch-Waxman patent infringement case. At that same time, Amneal had what they called a commercial batch size product that was a larger batch than these exhibit batches, and you may have seen that in the briefing. It's called the 157 batch. Amneal had never provided that particular batch to Merck in discovery. And at some point, when Merck realized they had provided it, this is in 2015.
That was not given to the FDA?
The batches are never given to FDA. However, data from the batches are usually used.
Follow through. You started off by telling us about the first ANDA and the exhibit batches. And that data was given to FDA.
Data was used for that for the FDA.
And then before the ANDA was amended, right, the commercial batches get
They had made a commercial batch called the 157 batch. It's referred to as the 157 batch in the brief.
1,000-kilogram bottles?
1,000-kilogram batch.
Okay.
And Amneal had never provided samples of that batch to Merck. Once it was realized they had actually made that batch, we went to the court and asked the court to force Amneal to give us samples of that batch. Because that, at the time...
Was there an outstanding discovery order against Amneal at the time they produced the commercial batch?
Absolutely. For everything they
when
had...
And you say you filed your suit on the first ANDA of 2013?
I think it was 15. It was in 2015. The exhibit batches were made in 2013.
Right. When was the discovery order?
The discovery request, you know, I don't have the date right now, but it would have gone...
I'm looking at one in December 2015.
The discovery request would have gone out shortly after the lawsuit was filed. And we actually held hearings.
I was just pointing out, when you said, well, they never gave you the commercial batch. I was trying to... You got the commercial batch in due course.
We had to go to the court toward the end of 2015, and they had to be ordered to give us the actual 157 batch.
And now we're up to January 2016, and things start happening with
Things start happening with breakneck speed. So shortly after, a little bit more than a week after they were ordered by the court, by the district court, to give us the 157 batch, they say, oh, forget that batch now that we have to give it to you. We're going to change and we're going to modify our ANDA. And we're going to file amendments. And by the way, the FDA had asked us to make another batch. This is the infamous in the briefing, the 16001 batch. And that's when they let us know about this. And by the way, we'll amend the ANDA, and now we'll make our commercial size batch a 100-kilogram batch. So what we have, things start happening in breakneck speed. The court orders them to give us any commercial size batches that they produce in response to the FDA. So they start in January to make the 16001 batch. They go through the first part of the process of making it, which involves putting the different ingredients, mixing them, stirring the pot with different mixers. This is not just mixing things lightly. These are high-speed blenders and industrial scale. And they get to a point where the first part of the process is finished, and that happens on January 11th, 2016. And that's when they drew the samples that they gave us for the case, which are the 16001 day one samples.
So the January 11th samples are
exactly.
The day one samples. Then what?
Then, unbeknownst to us, they told us, here are your samples from our commercial bulk whole batch. That's what they called it at the time to us. Not
made it with 100 kilogram bats.
Yes. And they told us, this is the samples from our batch. They never told us the processing had been finished or anything like that. So this is now unbeknownst to us in this period until on January 14th, they restir this batch. And on January 15th, they actually remove another set of samples, which are called the day four samples, the 16001 day four samples.
Now, I'm sorry, that's on the 15th, even though
on the 15th of January.
Even though that's actually the fifth day, if day one is the 11th?
Well, I think they look at it in between, the different days.
And in order to get to that sample, was there mixing between January 11th and January 14th?
There was mixing, and that's actually a judicial admission they made in a stipulation they filed with the court.
Okay.
And
that's what's called the day four?
That's called the day four samples. And they, by the way, they got data from those day four samples and submitted those to the FDA. Now, on the 15th also, they proceeded and they bottled some of the, they actually finished the entire process and put it in the actual bottles, the spray bottles. It's a nasal spray. And now, all of this is happening unbeknownst.
Does that have a different name?
That's called the 16001A.
And was there any difference, any additional mixing between the creation of day four and the A?
And there's still a little bit of mixing because as they put it in the bottles, they have to mix it again.
Okay.
And
you eventually, in May at least, asked for what?
Actually,
day four and A?
Actually, it's a little bit worse than that because in February, after we thought we had gotten the final, we needed some more samples. Say, hey, give us some more of your final batch you made for the FDA. Mm. Now they have finished all the processing. They still give us the day one samples. Again, we have no idea that they hadn't finished it. At the same time, they're producing documents to us. The documents go down through March. Around March 10th, they keep producing documents.
And there are some documents, some batch records in February that indicate that there existed these day four and A samples.
Correct. They would have been created at that time, but we didn't get complete discovery until March 10th.
So you got the documents on March 10th that would have indicated that there
were
other batches
exactly
when, in
but
existence.
We got their completed document production related to that on March 10th. So
this was all in January of 2016, right?
That's in the early part of 2016, January through March of 2016.
Right, and so you were given when were you given the day one samples?
The first part of them they sent it to us on January 11th.
You got them on January 11th?
Yes. So now what happens?
Can I ask you a question about the 1601A batch?
16001A.
Yeah, 16001A batch. So was that ever, was data collected from that, and was that provided to the FDA, or so the data from that sample?
They got data. The last data we know for sure they gave to the FDA. We don't know what they've done since, but they definitely gave data to the FDA from the day 4 samples.
But not from the 16001A samples?
Not that we know from their production, but they definitely did it from the day 4 samples, which have a 4-day period and more mixing.
At some point in time, your client became aware of the day 4 sample and the 16001A.
Well, right? The way we did is because when they filed their responsive rebuttal expert reports, all of a sudden they had one expert that provided a report that actually used data and cited data from the 16001 day 4 samples. And we're like, wait a minute, what's this? And at the same time...
What date was that?
That would have been...
That your client became aware of the existence of the day 4 and the 01A.
That would have been on April 25th was when their rebuttal reports were due.
Okay.
And that's appendix page 40, DI 115.
Okay. Now, after that date,
so,
April 25th, and before, you had a hearing on June 7th when all this topic was being discussed in great detail.
So,
even May 25th, wasn't there a discovery conference on May 25th?
There were a number of discovery conferences.
When did this issue first become a topic of communications, either between the parties or with the judge?
So we received their rebuttal expert reports, and all of a sudden we see that they have data that have been submitted to FDA from the day 4 samples, which we never had gotten. And we also see that they criticize our expert for opening the bottle, because they gave us those samples from day 1 in actual little screw top bottles as opposed to a nasal spray. And we say, wait a minute, how do they have data from day 4, which they never gave us any, you know, this is data we didn't have. How did they, samples that we didn't have for this data. And then they also, why are they criticizing our expert for opening the bottle with a screw top? That's what they gave it us, and that made us, prompt us to go back carefully through all their batch records that they had given us in March and say, wait a minute, they actually completed this production and actually put product in the nasal spray bottles, which is the finished version of the product.
Did you then move the court for production? You had an outstanding discovery order from way back, right?
We absolutely did. We actually
When did you go to the court and say, hey, they have something they haven't given us?
We went immediately to the court, and we started having hearings in May.
Give me some dates and some records.
So, for example, we had an emergency motion on May 9th, and that's on appendix page 112, paragraph 1. We had a second emergency motion on May 13th. It's in appendix page 112.
Did the emergency motion ask for these particular things?
Yes, absolutely, because what we were telling the court...
Can you show me where in that motion? Appendix 112, it goes 114, 15.
Yeah, this reflects that the motions in this court, Your Honor, are made by email.
I'm just trying to see where it is you are actually saying to the judge, hey, they've got something that's covered by a discovery order and they haven't given it to us.
But, I mean, I can actually do one better for that, because in one of these pretrial hearings, and we have the transcript of that, which is in appendix 128, and it's on pages 26 to line 15.
Right.
128 of the appendix.
Yeah,
appendix 128. That's during a hearing, The trial court was actually troubled about this issue.
Well, she said it had been better for process if they provided both samples, but they didn't. And my question is sort of, at what point did you ask for, did you point out that you wanted them to be given over?
Okay. We had asked early in discovery, and in fact, back in December, we had a court order specifically saying that they were to produce to us representative commercial batches sent to the FDA. And that's on appendix page 82, paragraph...
I thought they didn't send in that, the day four stuff to the FDA.
They send data. No samples actually get sent to the FDA.
I understand the samples.
But they send data from the day four samples to the FDA. They actually, and we have an admission on that, and that is actually... If you look in the appendix, on page 116, it's on paragraph 28 at the very bottom of the page, and this is a stipulation they submitted to the court, so it constitutes a judicial admission. On January 15, 2016, additional samples were drawn from the 200-liter mixing tank referenced in the exhibit batch protocol for FDA testing by Amneal. Now...
They were drawn.
I'm sorry?
Additional samples were drawn, and is that the day 14 stuff?
Day 4.
Yeah, that's the day 4 samples.
Okay.
That's exactly. So they used it for FDA testing. That's with respect to those day 4 samples. And actually, I can take you to their amended ANDA, and that's on appendix.
This is a statement of facts regarding it. It's just saying that they drew the sample, right?
For testing for FDA, though, to test it for the FDA. And then if you go to the appendix on page 2197 in the joint appendix, that's part
page
of their amendment.
Which?
Page 2197.
All of which is under confidentiality.
Yes, so I'm not going to read anything.
What does that show?
What do you want us to look at?
So if you look, there is a table that starts on the bottom part of the page and carries over, and you will see there it refers to the batch 16001, and on the very right-hand column, you will see all that is data from the testing they referred to on that paragraph 28 of their stipulation, and that was submitted to FDA.
You had referred earlier to a court order in December requiring Amneal to give all commercial batches, I guess, that had been submitted to the FDA, and then you were going to give a site. What was that site?
Yes. That's in DI 95 in the case, and it's reflected in appendix page 82, paragraph 1B again.
So at what point did you understand that data had been submitted to the FDA?
Once, that data had been submitted to the FDA, when we received their rebuttal reports and we saw they were trying to use...
From their expert report?
From their expert report. They ended up withdrawing that expert report, but that's how we knew they had actually...
You saw that data, and you knew it had been submitted to FDA back in that earlier period of time, April 25.
That would have been the time period where we started...
I'm just under data.
Yeah, that would have been the time period where we were starting to figure that out.
And yet when the judge tells you what I want to see is what's been submitted to FDA, you didn't point out to her that had been submitted to FDA.
Well, at the time...
She said that in her, didn't she, directly.
At the time, we had no reason to think that what they'd given to us, because they were under order, they had told the court...
You knew you hadn't been given something that had been given to the FDA.
Actually, we didn't at the time, because what they gave us, what they told us was their product in those bottles.
No,
they didn't tell us we drew...
You told me as of April, right, you knew that they had material on day four that they had given to the FDA.
No, I said as of April we had reason to look on, and we went immediately to the court with an emergency motion telling the court, look, they have material here that is more advanced, and they gave us...
What I'm sort of trying to get at is the judge realizes that there's a moving target here, but the judge says to you at a hearing on May 26th, what I want to make sure is I'm spending my time describing it, which is relevant, that the data presented to me is the same data presented to the FDA. That's all I'm asking. That's what she says, but you do not say to her later, a couple of weeks later at a hearing, before the trial, well, they've got something they gave the FDA that they're not giving us.
No, we had told her that a number of times. We actually had three hearings where we specifically said they have materials where they have given,
If you give me a minute, I can actually.
I don't mean to push you here, but I'm just trying to get inside of Judge Robinson's mind if I can, because she's asking for all the data that's gone to the FDA.
She's asking for all the data to make sure that we have everything that reflects data that's gone to the FDA. But I think the patent aspect of this, and I think the district court had some confusion here, is that if you look at the case law, what's at issue here is that we're supposed to test the final product.
Well, let me. I doubt that that's what the case law says. I think what the case law says is that you have to have evidence that shows what's in the final product. It doesn't say it has to be direct evidence. I gather that at the core of what Judge Robinson did was to say, it's late in the day. If they have to give you something they didn't give you that may well be closer to the final product, there's going to be a cost. There's going to be a cost of delay because there's going to have to be testing. You have to justify that cost. I'm going to let you try to justify that cost at trial by showing me that there is good enough reason to think that testing the day one, which you have had for a while, is not really reliably indicative of what you would discover if you could test day four and the A. And then she concludes, you didn't show me that, and therefore I can draw a conclusion about the final product from the evidence we have, which is the day one. Now, why is there an abuse in all of that?
I will respectfully disagree.
I will tell you
exactly why. Is because I actually do believe the case law specifically directs us that in an ANDA case, we're supposed to look at the finished product, and that's the Faring case, the Faring v. Watson case. There, what we have is we had the patentee.
You're supposed to determine what the final product would be and whether it would fit under the patent. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have to determine it by having the final product in hand and examining it. There can be indirect evidence if it's good enough.
There can be, but the indirect evidence cannot be an incomplete product. And we do have a factual finding from the court here that she heard the expert testimony, and she did specifically hold, and it's a factual finding that has not been disputed on appeal, that additional and faster mixing does indeed cause or tends to promote the conversion of the non-infringing form of this active ingredient to the infringing form of the active ingredient. So I do think when we have, on one hand, a finding that says that, you know, she finds that additional mixing, she believes the expert that says additional mixing does tend to promote the conversion to the infringing form. What we have here is an intermediate that we know was mixed, and that's by their own admission and by the process records that are in evidence. And we know that's been substantial mixing after that point. I don't understand how you can say to a patentee, well, too bad if you didn't have good enough evidence because we gave you something that was further processed in a way that the fact-finding by the district court says that particular further processing may have caused the conversion. I mean, frankly, I don't see how we can prove that this wouldn't matter, or how anybody could know it wouldn't matter, when we do know that the additional mixing could cause it, and what we have is an incomplete product. And this is, I believe, particularly problematic when we know that the finished product was sitting in their warehouse. And here's an additional problem, and this is why I believe the district court in the end was confused. The district court not only considered...
Well, I mean, the finished, you have to put all the facts in, the finished product sitting in the warehouse, and Amneal was saying we're never going to market that stuff. We're not going to have things sit for 4 days before we put it in the bottle.
Well,
we're trying to look at something representative of the product that's going to go into the public domain, right?
They say in their brief on page 10 that this is not what they're going to do. However, that's incorrect. Because their actual process, and remember, in an ANDA case, what we have to look at...
Would that matter under Synovian?
Absolutely would matter under Synovian. Absolutely.
No. I mean, that is, if they say, sorry, we're allowed to do this by the application, but we're not going to, I thought Synovian says, we don't really care whether you...
Absolutely. It's what you can do. It's what you can do. They can say all they want, they're not going to do it. And, Your Honors, I would direct you to the appendix on page 3410. And there you can actually see what's their master production record in their amended ANDA. And it specifically says... Maximum bulk suspension hold time is not more than 4 days. So even though they say in their briefing, which is just attorney argument, oh, we're not going to hold it, that's not really our process to hold it for 4 days, their ANDA says they can hold it for 4 days. That's why this particular batch was so relevant. It's and under Synovian, you're exactly...
The other batch is relevant too, though, right? Because isn't the day one batch relevant as well, since... It also falls within the specification in the sense that it says you can hold it up to 4 days. But the day one is relevant because that's up to 4 days as well.
So let's say they made one...
relevant day three.
You're exactly... Let's say they made one batch and they only held it 1 day and then they bottled it, right? That would be relevant. But at the same time, during an ANDA case, during a Hatch-Waxman case, if they had made other batches that they held for 4 days... Because that's something they're allowed to do under their ANDA, and you're exactly correct, Your Honor, under Synovian, if anything they can do under their ANDA infringes, then we have a Hatch-Waxman infringing act.
I'm a little confused by your brief. I understand what you're saying here today, but I'm a little confused by your brief because your brief reads as if it's framed as if you're saying the day one data was some sort of intermediate product. It's not the final product. It's not the product according to the ANDA spec. I needed to have the day four sample. But I don't see you arguing that there's an abuse of discretion by the district court judge in not allowing you to have the discovery.
There is something that led to a legal error, because what we have an infringement case where what we examine is not the actual product, but an intermediate. Now, the reason the day one, in the way they gave it to us, is not even a product. Because let's assume they had actually held it until day one, but then gone through their bottling protocol to end up putting it in the bottle, which includes more mixing. That would have been a final product under a different version, right? Because they would have done the hold only for 1 day instead of doing the hold for 4 days. But what they did here, what they took out of on January 11th, 2016, what they took out, they didn't finish bottling that. They just went into the vat and pulled out an incomplete product that was never bottled. So that was, you know, an incomplete, in-process product. It had never followed the final steps. And in this case, where the processing matters as to whether we have an infringing product or not, and we know it matters because we have a fact finding from the district court that says additional mixing does matter. And again, I think that's very important because they never contested this fact finding.
What she actually said is the court concludes that generally additional or faster mixing tends to promote conversion of MFA to MFM. Did she say that in the context, though, of the product? Or did she just say generally in the context of anything, you know, additional mixing? Because her opinion in multiple places says, you've shown something, you've shown me that something could happen in the conversion from MFA to MFM, but maybe not in the context of the... product at issue.
Let's take it as a general... Well, the testimony all on that was in respect to what happens in the process on the product at issue. The question is, we can't prove that it happened in this case unless we have their final product.
Well, what you just said, I guess, as I was coming into this argument, struck me as the core of the issue. Could you actually have proved it? I understand you would have one argument if what you said is science recognizes that there is no close, reliable substitute for examining the end product. It's not clear to me whether that's this situation. To say that, in general, there is a tendency of mixing to promote conversion does not necessarily imply that the amount of mixing that they did between 1 and 4 and then the additional mixing from 4 to the bottle, that that would likely have any changing effect. And the question is, you were given an opportunity to prove that. Why wasn't Judge Robinson, you know, within her fact-finding discretion, entitled to say, you could have proved it, but you didn't prove it, and therefore I will infer about day 4 and A from what we know about 1?
Because it's inappropriate to render conclusions about the final product by looking at the intermediate. And I'll explain why. If we look at the Faring v. Watson case, right, in that case the roles were a little bit reversed, because what happened there is the branded company, the patentee, took an intermediate of the generic company, and they tried to say these little, you know, these granules that were uncoated, because their dissolution profile meets a certain spec, it infringes our patent. And what this court said in that instance was, wait a minute, you can't prove infringement by looking at an intermediate. There's no need to go to tie whether there is a link between that intermediate and the final product, especially in a situation where you have a final product. You test the final product to prove infringement. To put the patentee in a position where we have to, with absolute specificity, prove that the additional mixing in this particular instance would have caused conversion is, I frankly believe, almost an impossibility, because it's putting us in a position of having to say what would happen in this industrial process that we cannot replicate. We do believe, actually, the fact that Judge Robinson found that additional mixing with this ingredient does tend to promote conversion actually shows us that what happens here is the processing level and degree matters. We have a finding that says, in essence, processing matters here. And what we do know for a fact, without anybody arguing against it, is that what we had to test versus the finished product, which under Glaxo, under Abbott, under all the case law, is what is supposed to be looked at, is what is the final product under all patent law. What we have is a final product that we know has undergone further processing, including further mixing, from what they gave us.
Is there any final product here at all? Aren't they all intermediates?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Was there any final product here in suit, or are they all intermediates?
So the so-called exhibit batches we talked about, those were actually finished through and packaged, but at the same time, what we have for those is we have the fact, and we have a finding again from the district court, that those were not mixed according. Those were not mixed according to the ANDA process, and she says she actually specifically found those were mixed at 1/2 to 1/3 the minimum allowable speed. So those were not mixed according to the ANDA process. So what we're saying is, if we're going to have,
so the exhibit batch was out, the commercial batch was out, right? And from your perspective, all of the day 1 to through day 4 are intermediates.
Well, the day 4 is an intermediate too. It's a better intermediate, right? Because it has received more mixing, so it's closer to the final product. It certainly is something.
What I hear you be saying is there is nothing, this case doesn't present any product that could be legally said to be representative of what was going to be marketed.
In what was actually tested, that is correct, especially with knowledge that.
You're sort of saying you, for purposes of infringement, you're entitled to test something that is representative of what's going to market.
Exactly, Your Honor.
You have an entitlement to that. And so you're saying in this case there's a total absence of that evidence. So this case could not have gone to trial legally.
Well, and that's what we tried to avoid. We do believe that.
I didn't see any motion to that effect. I didn't. And Judge Robinson's musings and her agony over what was going on, I didn't see her being presented with it, saying you can't go to trial ma'am, because you have not given us the opportunity to test a representative sample.
There were probably about three hearings, and I'll be happy to provide you with sites. I mean, I don't have them right now. There were three hearings where that was the topic, trying to tell her, look, we need to get this finished product to test it. And if you look, in fact, where she said, it's a fact of life that people don't always make the best decisions, it would have been better for the process if Amil had provided both samples, but they didn't. She closes that paragraph by saying, but I won't push the trial. Because she was focused, and sometimes it's perhaps...
Is day four an intermediate?
Day four is actually still an intermediate, but is closer...
Well, I know, but from your perspective, yeah, that's no good either.
You're
asking for something that's no good as a matter of law.
We believe that 1601A is actually the closest thing to the product and what should be tested. In the absence of that, and because her order had said they were under an order to give us everything they used for the FDA, and we did know that 1601 day four samples had been used for the FDA, but they didn't give us, those were actually a better substitute than something that goes several steps before the final product.
I think we need to switch over to the other side now. We've gone 20 minutes over, and you should please add that to Mr. Meloro's time if you need it. I think quite a lot of the extra time was taken up by at least what I consider precisely laying the table, so maybe you won't need the whole thing. But we might ask you a few questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Thomas Meloro for Amneal. The judgment of non-infringement should be affirmed because Judge Robinson, the district court, clearly found that there was no conversion, no proof of conversion from MFA to MFM. There was no clear error in the fact findings. The testing of the 16001 samples by Dr. Matzker was proven not to show conversion.
I'm sorry, the samples that he tested, is it he? Yeah.
16,
he
yes.
Tested just the day one samples.
The day one samples.
Right, so he didn't have the day four sample or the A sample.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right, so am I misunderstanding what at least how I think of the core dispute here is the question is, does it matter that they did not have the opportunity to test two samples that were closer to the final, one of the final products that is permitted under the ANDA, namely a wait to day four product, and whether it matters that they didn't, or whether Judge Robinson could find they had an opportunity to show that it mattered, namely the difference between the day one sample and the two later samples. They could have shown it, they didn't show it, and therefore it doesn't matter that they didn't have the second and third.
It doesn't matter that they didn't have the second and third, the day four samples and the 001A samples.
Now, why is that, given that there is actually a finding that additional mixing, tell me if I've got the language wrong, but because I think the language matters quite a lot here, tends to cause more to enhance conversion.
The language I believe you're referring to is at A14, and
it's actually at A13.
Sorry, A13, and the court says the court concludes that generally, additional or faster mixing tends to promote conversion of MFA to MFM. The court did provide Merck with opportunity at trial to attempt to show that the 001A samples, that there would have been some conversion from MFA to MFM. Judge Robinson specifically said that she would permit Merck to even have additional trial time. As the court knows, trials
so
in Delaware.
So how would they have been able to do that in a scientifically reliable way without having the day four or the bottled four samples to test, to compare them to the day one?
Well, in the end, and remembering it's Merck's burden, they didn't even try, and their expert...
You tell me if I'm just misfocusing. It seems to me if she said, I will give you the opportunity to prove something that scientifically you cannot prove, that's not much of an opportunity. So tell me why science would have allowed them to prove that the mixing that of the sort that was going on as you moved from day one to day four, and as you moved from day four to the A samples, why that could really have mattered. How would they have done that?
They could have done testing with material that they had. They could have done testing within samples that they had or samples that they might have made.
What kind of testing?
The record doesn't reflect the kind of testing that Merck may have done. What the record reflects is...
Are you aware of anything that they could have done?
The testing that they could have done would have been to take some of the samples that they had, for example, and subjected them to more mixing. Some testing that they could have done was actually observational type testing.
Not just more mixing, not just, it would have been day four mixing, because it's the day four mixing sample that we're talking about as having been error in its exclusion, not something else. So to answer the presiding judge's question, what could they have done to what they had there other than to, because they didn't have day four to test?
They had day one samples on day four. So in essence, they had day four samples. Day four mixing.
And how much did they know about the rate and duration of the mixing that you all did between day one and day four?
I believe they had the full details of all of that by, I'll take counsel's representation, March 10th.
That was mixing in 100 kilogram volumes?
Correct, Your Honor. It was 100.
I assume that they did not have 100 kilograms of your day one product?
They did not have, I don't know the amounts.
Could they, with some, I'm going to assume, much smaller amount, have replicated the duration and speed and, I don't know, whether it was intermittent or replicated the mixing that you did in the 100-gram volumes, could they have replicated that in the smaller volumes that they had in a way that would allow the conclusion to be drawn as to what was actually happening in your larger volume?
They could have and should have tried. They didn't do anything. I will submit
that... Could they have done that even given that trial was 6 weeks later and expert reports had already been prepared? Does that change your view on whether they could have done it?
The timing was more than sufficient to permit it. The testing could have happened as soon as January 12th, when the samples were provided. They could have taken some portion of those samples, tested them at it as is. They could have tested further by mixing other aspects.
What reason would they have had to do that? Did they know about the day four at that point in time?
They knew about it by the beginning of March, Your Honor, or they had the information in their hands by the beginning of March.
So the January date you just mentioned is irrelevant?
They could have done further testing.
Well, they wouldn't have any reason to do that, to look for it, because they didn't know you did the day four.
Well, they knew what they had was not packaged because of the nature in which they got it. It was in a screw-top bottle, and they had the manufacturing specifications from the ANDA, so they knew that packaging would provide some additional mixing in the course of packaging. So they had in their hands the information from which they would have known that the bulk day one material they had would be subject to some further mixing if bottled.
But can I just, I don't know if this matters, but as I understand it, between day one and the spray bottles, there are two mixings. There's the one from day one to day four, and then there's the one from day four to bottling. Is it right or wrong that that second mixing is much, 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 much smaller than the first mixing from one to four?
There can be two mixings if you go to day four before bottling, so that there don't have to be two mixings. if there are two mixings.
Right, but just in terms of when they got the sealed little bottles of day one, they knew that's not how it was going to go onto the CVS shelf. So they may have known that when they're put into the spray bottles, there's a bit of additional mixing, but may have thought that's not going to be a lot. But they didn't know about what might have been a much more meaningful amount of mixing in the day one, day four process. When did they first learn, as far as the record tells us, about the amount of mixing that took place between day one and day four?
They would have had that information by March the 10th, Your
That's
Honor.
That's all part of that February
They would have. They would have that.
Discussion.
And as a matter of fact, the additional, as the court put it, little mixing in the bottling.
I'm just wondering if
that additional mixing in the bottling is what counsel says is the entirety of the problem here. Because remember, everything else that Merck argues comes before the bottling is not the finished product. And so it is only that last bit of mixing that Merck says makes all the difference in the world,
right,
because they didn't get those samples.
But as I think you heard me say, I'm not at this point at least persuaded that our case law says you must have and look at and actually have eyes on the finished product in order to make a determination about the finished product. So on the assumption that the required determination is one about the finished product, the question is how close to that did they have something that would enable the district court to draw a reliable conclusion about it. And
yes.
What they had was two steps away from the spray bottle version, not just one.
It was one step away from what you could have to the finished product under the ANDA, but it was two steps away in this particular instance. You could have one step from day one to bottling, or you could have two steps, day one, then day four, then bottling. So in this instance, what they had was two steps, and what they had, they tested, and there was no conversion from MFA to MFM in that product, and they took no additional steps, despite knowing from the district court that they would be given opportunities to make proof. They offered nothing. They made no effort. They made no attempt at all to see if any further processing of the material they had would make any difference whatsoever. And in fact, their expert said that his testimony was theoretical. This was Dr. Trout. And that you would need to do testing, and they did no testing whatsoever.
But he meant he would need to do testing on the day four data and the batch A data, right? Isn't that what he meant?
No, I think Dr. Trout gave more fundamental testimony.
He said that he would have to do testing. What kind of testing was he referring to?
He said that you would need to do testing on specific systems and that he didn't attempt any tests on Amneal's system and that he had not considered the Chen reference and that sometimes agitation actually decreases nucleation, doesn't increase it. It was also interesting here that Dr. Rogers looked at the data from Dr. Marquardt, who was Merck's expert, who testified about the 16001.
Dr. Rogers was your guy?
Yes. And Dr. Rogers looked at the data and showed that if you looked at the samples that Dr. Marquardt tested over time, there was absolutely no growth in what Dr. Marquardt thought and testified was the converted MFM. So if there was conversion going on here, over time, the expert said it would be increasing and you would see more conversion over time. And there was, I believe, a 7-week gap or passage of time from the beginning of Dr. Marquardt's testing to the end of Dr. Marquardt's testing. And Dr. Rogers said there was nothing indicating at all that there was any growth, there was any increased nucleation, there was any conversion going on here. So the real world, if this material was already converting on day one because the product converts. Then, over the course of 7 weeks, one would have expected to see more. And, in fact, there was nothing that Dr. Rogers saw, and that was unrebutted at trial. Dr. Marquardt didn't come back and say, no, I looked after 7 weeks, and, in fact, it was growing. The reality of the situation is there is no conversion. The samples were provided from the day one. Those samples were tested. There was no effort by Merck to do anything more with them, but data was generated over an extended period of time, and that testimony from Dr. Rogers is at A298.
Given Buford's order in December that Amneal was to give all commercial batches that had been provided, on which data had been provided to the FDA, that it was supposed to produce them, why weren't the day four batches produced?
Because the day four batches were the same material as the day one batches. There was just a homogenization of the material on day four so that they could be retested. The purpose of
They've gotten four days older, right?
That's correct. They got 4 days older.
Isn't the evidence that the process of the chemical, the change, occurs over time?
If there is conversion, over time the conversion should increase.
It escalates over time.
It should, according to Dr. Rogers, if you're having it.
Right. So if you tested the day one samples today, would the scientists would they expect the test results to be exactly what they were when they were tested 2 or 3 years ago?
There are shelf life that I think is 2 years.
Just forget about the shelf life. Say, for example, if I test them at the end of the shelf life, would the test be the same as you test them on the day you bought it?
Within the specifications of the product, it should be the same if the shelf life is meaningful at 2 years.
And so there wouldn't have been any further conversion?
Well, if you have conversion of MFA to MFM, you would expect that conversion to continue and grow over time.
Well, that's what I mean. So you might find more in the later product.
And Merck had those samples for 6 months before trial.
So the question here is whether there was a difference between 1 day and 4 days.
And the evidence is that Dr. Marquardt, overlooking it over 7 weeks, saw no difference.
Right, but I thought the questions that the presiding judge was asking, in essence, was whether or not the four extra days really matter.
It wouldn't matter here.
Judge Robinson gave them the opportunity to prove why it might have mattered.
She did, and
their answer was, well, as you noticed yourself, Your Honor, over time, the conversion escalates.
It would be expected to escalate.
And for 4 days is time.
4 days is time. It's 4 days that Merck
has. Plus the fact there's been some more jiggling. There's been some additional agitation. Agitation also escalates conversion.
The evidence is there is no conversion here. And the 4 day passage of time is a 4 day passage of time, both in Merck's labs.
The evidence is there's no conversion on the three peak as to day one. But the question is, I think the way I heard the question the presiding judge was putting is whether or not the option that Judge Robinson gave to Merck is illusory. How could they possibly prove that day four was different from day one unless they can test day four, when their operative thesis is that over time and agitation, you enhance the conversion?
And the response to that is that Merck had those opportunities both to do their own testing.
Well, then you go back and they say, well, they could have done their own testing on this stuff you gave them earlier day one, but then you realize they would have had to done some extrapolation because it wasn't exactly the same as day four stuff. So they would have had to do some mathematics and create a construct that said what we're doing is equal to what day four would look like if we tested it. And you would have objected to that up one side and down the other, saying, oh, no, that's not a good comparison.
What would have happened if Merck actually tried to present evidence is it would have been subject to cross-examination as to how representative it was. And if they came up with representative testing.
That would be because they were using separate representative as opposed to the real product, which is what they're asking for.
and the opportunity that they were given at trial was to show that there was something meaningful about not having those 16001A samples. And so I don't think that the district court would have expected a perfect replication of 100% to even get them in the ballpark of saying that the 16001A samples mattered here. What Judge Robinson wanted to see was evidence that was something more than a theoretical argument that this might happen.
You said something before, and maybe I didn't quite get it, about Dr. Marquardt, was it, looked at something and nothing happened over 7 weeks? What was that?
So this was Dr. Rogers' testimony. If I said Dr. Marquardt, I misspoke.
No, you probably didn't.
So at A298, Dr. Rogers testified that he looked at the underlying data. Dr. Marquardt thought that in 3 of the 7 samples that he tested, he saw conversion. And Dr. Rogers said he looked at additional samples taken over time and that he would have expected to see growth if, in fact, what Dr. Marquardt was seeing was conversion.
Okay, so Rogers was looking at what exactly?
Underlying data from Dr. Marquardt. Amneal's expert, Dr. Rogers, looked at Merck's expert's underlying data.
Okay, and Dr. Marquardt's data was exactly of what? About what?
This was the sampling of the 16001 day one batches.
And so he was looking at day one batches on day 14 and day 33 and day 48 and day 57. Is that what you're talking about?
It was an analysis that
single batch, what happened to that batch over time. I think we need like 15 more minutes because I think he didn't add the 20 minutes to his 15 minutes. Thanks.
So these were sample preparations happening over time. So in essence...
But all day one.
All day one.
Right. And what's at issue here, as I understand it, is that if there's early additional mixing, the mixing that occurred, I'm about to ask you about this, between day one and day four, that might have made a change that would change the trajectory into day 43 and 58 and 94 and 122 and 730. And we don't know what that difference would have been.
The mixing on day four is designed to make the sample homogeneous.
You used the term just homogenization before. Can you describe what the record tells us about what kind of mixing occurs, at what rate, what duration, when between day one and day four?
I will find that site for you. I don't have it.
Well, maybe you can even just describe it without giving the site at the moment.
It is taking the samples from day one and mixing so that the material is designed to be homogeneous so that what you test on day four is representative in case the material, I'll use the term settling, if there's anything that's happened.
Is that a process that's going on for the entire 72 hours between day one and day
four? My understanding is no.
Or just before you do the sample at hour 72?
It's just before you do the sampling on day four.
And now, is it, I don't know, a gentle stirring or a something more vigorous?
It is... I don't know that it's stirring.
That's the opposite of the scientifically precise term. But I mean, I guess I'm trying to get a sense of how much mixing there was that even could have changed the day one versus day four product.
The mixing that was done on day four. Let me see if I can find the exact citation for the court so that you can see what the response is. And there was...
What's the purpose of the mixing?
On day four, the purpose of the mixing is to ensure that the sample is homogeneous for testing.
So it's all the ingredients haven't separated and whatnot. You're mixing it back up.
Exactly.
Again.
And the data that Dr. Rogers looked at and testified about on A298, he also mixed... so that it would be homogeneous, or Dr. Marquardt mixed so that it would be homogeneous. I'm not saying that the two mixings were the same, but I am saying that
And they were at different times, so at least conceivably an early mixing could could spark the beginning of something that would then kind of exponential, would compound, basically.
I don't believe there was any record evidence that that was a possibility.
I was going to ask you, is there any testimony at all to support the idea that early mixing is more significant than
later
mixing?
I don't recall any evidence that early mixing in day four for homogenization purposes would be any different than the mixing for homogenization purposes that Dr. Marquardt did with his samples.
But there is some testimony in the record that once you have some conversion occurring, then the conversion would happen.
It should progress.
Well, it would progress.
It should progress.
As the equilibrium changes.
I think the experts agreed that if you have conversion, it should progress.
Under your theory, if Merck had succeeded with the invitation given to it by Judge Robinson, they would have come forward with some form of scientific information based on some further testing of day one samples saying, look here, see, it does convert more.
Yep.
And so then Judge Robinson would have said, okay, you've met your burden. I'm not going to have the trial, or I'm going to stop the trial. She's making this proof at the bench trial, right?
Correct.
She would have said, I'm going to stop the bench trial. We're going to cancel it. We're going to go back, and you've got to give them day four, and then we'll start the trial again.
That's
what would have happened?
That's one result that could have happened. And Judge Robinson did not limit the proof that Merck could offer in any way. Testing the day one samples would have been a very logical thing for Merck to have done, further processing and testing. They still had the exhibit batches. They could have done some further testing and analysis with those. They could have made up their own samples and tried to show how that was providing informative information to the court. The district court did not in any way.
Did they have enough information about? I guess they did. That's their product, right? About how to. Well, did they have enough information about how you made day one that in their own labs or production facilities they could have made a 100-gram batch of your product?
They could have made MFA. They couldn't have made it using the exact equipment, and I think the parties' experts agree that the exact equipment can matter, but that's for an exact replication. There was absolutely no effort to generate any evidence at all to show Judge Robinson that there was smoke here that should be pursued. There was zero offer of proof beyond theory.
And between the date upon which Merck was given the invitation and the date the trial started was what? What's the time period in which they had jumped forward?
The 25th of May, I believe, was the last discovery conference where the court made clear that the trial would go forward. The information was in Merck's hands from early March. And the information, according to Merck, they affirmatively knew about the information much before then.
And I think Judge Stoll asked you this question before, but I don't remember the answer. Why didn't you give them the day four and the A in January 15th?
The day four was essentially the same as the day one. It was just suspended for testing purposes for the FDA wanted to see data on day one and day four.
Was there not an outstanding discovery request for anything that, what was the outstanding discovery request?
I believe it was referenced during the earlier questioning of counsel for Merck, and it's at A82. At 1B, further representative commercial batches sent to the FDA. And the day one samples satisfied that obligation. And when Merck argued for the day four samples.
That's because you didn't consider it a commercial batch? The day four samples were given to FDA, according to the record.
They were considered by Amneal to be the same as the day one samples.
What was given to the FDA?
Records
of or batches of?
Records related to testing, I'm sorry, not the batches themselves.
And so what this means is not what it actually says. Make available to Merck samples of any further batches sent to the FDA. I gather you didn't actually send any batches to the FDA.
I'm not aware of the material actually going to the FDA, just data that was tested. data generated from testing the material. And so the production of the 001 day one samples was deemed by Amneal to satisfy 1B of the court's order.
But your adversary pointed to us when his argument in chief, day four data that was given to FDA.
It was, and that data was given to Merck with the production in February and March. The Amneal view, and it was fully aired in the district court, was that the day one and the day four samples, it's the same material. It is the material that's going to be put in the bottles and sold. Merck says that there was some further processing. All that happened on day four was making sure it was uniform for the testing.
I mean, another way to say that is you agree that there was some further processing. You disagree about the potential significance of that, but there was some, whether, you know, what you call just homogenization and whatever else takes place as you put it into the little spray bottles. So there is a difference. The only question is whether it's of any significance. And now, by the time this kind of ripened into a dispute in front of Judge Robinson, there was this kind of what do we do now question about scientific uncertainty about whether this mattered or not, and a looming trial deadline.
And Judge Robinson did what district judges are empowered to do. She managed the discovery process and the trial process. She was clearly very aware of the competing considerations and prejudices to both parties.
Can I ask if you know, in the middle of the trial, the way Judge Clevenger was talking about, or even on May 25th, she had said, okay, you got to give them the day four samples. And the day four samples at that point would have been day 124 samples or
something like that.
Yeah. What then would have had to happen for the parties to prepare through expert reports or further testing or something to assess the significance of this new batch?
I don't think that was discussed specifically with the district court, but the expectation would be that both parties' experts might then do some further testing, prepare some further expert reports.
And did both parties agree that that process would have taken such time as necessitated a delay of the trial?
I think that the district court and both parties contemplated that the trial could not go forward on the schedule that was in place at that point in time. And that led to the discussion where Judge Robinson said, we're going to keep the trial date, we're going to go forward with the evidence we have now, but I'm going to give you, Merck, every opportunity, including more trial time, if necessary, to show me why this is not relevant evidence for me to decide the case on, because the district court wanted to be sure that she was very, very comfortable that the case she was deciding was a case that was representative of Amneal's product. And after listening to the experts for 2 days, airing of all the issues, the district court made fact findings, not subject to any clear error, that in fact she was trying and deciding the right case and that she had the relevant evidence, knowing that the 001A samples had been out there and hadn't been provided to Merck. The district court's fact findings on those issues, after listening to the experts for both sides, were not clearly erroneous, and for that reason, the judgment should be affirmed.
I want to ask you another question, going back to something we were just talking about. Okay, I assume you have a lot of ANDA experience, so I'm hoping you can help me with this. So it's a basic question, which is just that from the perspective of the FDA, would it, in looking at the ANDA application, have considered the day four batch as being a different batch than the day one batch?
I think it would not have considered it to be a different batch. I think the reason for the testing was the FDA wanted to see that the day one and day four material shared, I'll say, common characteristics, so that the possibility that the product could be held for 4 days before bottling under the ANDA manufacturing specifications wouldn't make a difference.
The FDA asked you to do the four-day testing, right?
My understanding is that request came from the FDA initially.
Yeah, they said you've got the right to keep it over 4 days. Do it and show me.
We want to make sure your product's not changing significantly over those 4 days.
But was there any focus on the question of conversion from MFA to MFM? That is, I can imagine, and it seems to me the FDA could request the day four to make sure there's no change relevant to FDA purposes, but not relevant to MFA to MFM purposes. Do we know anything about the reasons that the FDA thought that that day one to day four might be relevant?
I don't know that the FDA specifically said, we want this test because we want to make sure there's no conversion. But
does the FDA care if there's conversion?
The FDA should care if there's conversion. And in fact, the product that's being sold is a product that the FDA is content is MFA and not MFM. Now, I don't know what all the back and forth is after the product manufacturing is over.
Right, but if that's right, then it seems that the fact that the FDA wanted this testing and should care about the very patent issue that we're talking about suggests that it was perhaps inappropriately presumptuous for you to think that they didn't need, the other side, Merck didn't really need to see day four because it might actually be relevant to an issue that both the patent inquiry and the FDA inquiry cared about.
Well, I don't think there was a specific care from the FDA on that.
No, but you just said what the FDA had in front of it and needed to make sure the product would represent was a MFA, not MFM product. So the FDA cared that there wasn't going to be conversion in the two-year life.
They would have cared if they thought it was a concern, but there was no evidence that there was any concern at any point in time during the process. That's if FDA had come and said, we're concerned about conversion, please do a test to make sure there's no conversion, that would have been a very different circumstance than the case we have. The case was, you can hold your product for 4 days, we want you to look at it after 4 days and make sure we don't have problems here.
What do you mean by problems?
I was going to say, if I could speak generally about that. There were some characteristics that the
Is this the page in the appendix that we were
2197, I believe. Those.
That table that we can't talk about the details of, those are the kind of characteristics that need to be checked or something?
That's right. Now, one of the characteristics that was checked was that there was a band at 1725, which is consistent with MFA.
Can that is here? You think that's on this page?
It is.
Okay.
Can I ask, is this, suppose that we thought in the writing of our opinion that it would be extremely useful to be able to quote, refer to this? Is this something that you all can waive confidentiality on?
We are and would just simply request that the court only quote what it believes is necessary.
Okay. And this is your information, right?
It is Amneal's information.
So this is a question that...
Yeah. That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
If there are any further questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
Well, as I understand, at the very, very bottom line, your position is that In the circumstances, which we've now had, thanks to both of you, an opportunity to sort of get a feel as if we were there while it was happening, that in the circumstances, Judge Robinson knew that there was a potential problem with regard to Merck not having had an opportunity at an earlier stage in the game to assess day four or the day four that got bottled in the say, 01A. And so she says, I'm not going to stop right now, because perhaps she had a suspicion in her mind that it didn't really matter. She said, nobody's proven to me that it really matters. Here, Burke, you've got an opportunity. A trial will happen in a month or two or 3 months. Give it your best shot to convince me that I'm wrong. That's your perspective. And that offer was not illusory. That offer had a meaningful opportunity to Merck to go into its laboratories and do some testing to be able to come and make what you might call a prima facie showing that they were fully entitled to test day four and day four a bottle. and that they and that that was the offer that was made. Merck did not respond to the argument. Merck did not bring in evidence showing that it had made some preliminary testings to satisfy what I call the prima facie test.
And
therefore, she said, excuse me, I did not err in not having compelled you to give over those two items. That's your case.
That summarizes a lot of what I said. Now, Merck did respond.
Reviewing all that for abuse of discretion? That's a question I haven't asked either one of you earlier. What's the test?
You're reviewing for abuse of discretion Judge Robinson's decision to manage the docket that way, manage the trial schedule that way, manage the discovery issues that way. That is abuse of discretion. With respect to the specific issue of did Merck convince Judge Robinson that there was some relevance to the 001A samples, I think that's those are fact findings subject to a clear error standard within that abuse of discretion.
The way I thought I had characterized what I thought your position was that she gave them an opportunity to come forward with factual material that would prove that she should require the trial to stop so as to be able to test day four and day four bottle, but they did not bring forward that testimony.
They brought forth, to be fair, expert testimony on theories.
Well, that's what I mean. She said it was theoretical.
Yeah, they brought forth no
factual information, and so we would review that. Did they or didn't they bring forth factual information? The record doesn't show any factual information.
The record certainly doesn't show that. That's right. And Judge Robinson's
I'm trying to see if it really does collapse to a abuse of discretion evidentiary ruling as opposed to collapsing into, I mean, there are some mixed questions of law along here. Because Merck's omnibus argument is, well, the right samples were never put in play.
They try to make the legal argument. I think you know the Glaxo case and other cases make clear that as long as you're considering the relevant evidence, there's no.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Well, I think we have to walk through a legal minefield that Merck has presented to us, and if we come through that legal minefield saying there was no error of law, and you reduce it right down to the question of, well, did she make a mistake? What was the basis really of her ruling in her mind at the end? Was it an evidentiary call because Merck hadn't come forward to give her a reason to believe that she needed to allow the testimony to come in?
That's right. And there are subsidiary arguments about the evidence they did present, which they sort of walked away from that evidence today saying they can't prove anything. But at trial, they tried to prove that the evidence they had on the 001 day one samples was showing conversion. Judge Robinson found no conversion. That's a clear error standard on appeal. But this issue of the 001A samples, that's an abuse of discretion. That's classic discovery and docket management. And Judge Robinson drew what was a very fair line understanding the impact on both parties here and had the trial go forward, but gave Merck every opportunity to provide the information that would lead her to make the conclusion that that trial would have to stop or be postponed or be adjourned or be redone, potentially. This was not an illusory or hollow offer that the district court made.
I want to ask you just one question. You seem to be distinguishing between an abuse of discretion and clearly erroneous, but it's my understanding that a district court would abuse its discretion by relying on clearly erroneous facts.
That's my understanding as well.
Relying on a clear error of law, so I'm not sure it matters. What's your response to that?
That's my understanding is that a clear error can be an abuse of discretion, but the tests obviously are slightly different in terms of what can, in the aggregate, constitute an abuse of discretion.
Thank you, Mr. Maloro.
Thank you.
5 minutes?
I'll try.
Well,
I'll do it.
I think I'm actually going to stick to 5 minutes.
Let me start with what I notice is one concern you'll have, which is whether Merck had ever actually asked for this final product. And of course we had. And if you would turn to page 79 of the joint appendix, there's a court order in another instance ordering Amneal to produce things to us, and it reproduces our production request 15, which covers samples. It's on paragraph 5 on the top of appendix page 79, manufactured in accordance with the procedures for Amneal's ANDA product. That would have covered the 1601A samples that weren't given to us. Now, I'm a little bit, you know, we're here talking whether Merck should, they're talking about whether Merck should actually make a product on its own to test, which would lead to an incredible confusion and disastrous trial, because they would object to everything, when we actually have their ANDA product sitting in a warehouse, and is what we should have gotten. And the other question that I've noticed some concern about is what Merck told Judge Robinson about this. And as soon as we figured out they had actually continued the process on the batch 1601, we went repeatedly to her. So for example, on the June 7th pretrial conference, we specifically told her, and that's on DI 189 during the pretrial conference, we told her that the case is supposed to be upon the product they are seeking approval from the FDA for. And even in the post-trial briefing, we kept emphasizing an ANDA case is about is supposed to be about the actual product. And let me go back to what the law is and kind of on your last question about whether is this an abuse of discretion or this a legal error. You are correct. A judge gets to make calls on discovery, and those are subject to abuse of discretion. However, when those calls end up causing an error in law, we have to look at the legal error of the patent case. And our position is that taking into consideration what's in effect is not the product in order to determine or not determine whether it infringes is legal error. And I'm going to go back to Faring, which is the closest case from this court. It's Faring v. Watson. It's the closest case because it was a case, again, the roles were reversed, but the patentee was trying to use an intermediate. And this court said the uncoded cores of Watson's generic product is misplaced. The infringement evaluation is concerned only with the final coded commercial acid tablets when Watson that for which Watson sought and was granted FDA approval. So in an ANDA case, we're not looking at intermediates. We're supposed to look at the actual product, and that is the law. So her decisions, if you want to isolate them, you can look at them isolated, but what it led to is an ultimate judgment that's based upon a determination of infringement or non-infringement that's not based on the product.
If I don't agree with you that day one was an intermediate, don't you still have an argument? Because you could still argue to me, yes, but we need to be able to look at day four. Because even if day one didn't infringe, day four could infringe.
Exactly, and I'm very glad you brought that up, because there were some points made that day four isn't that different. It's just 4 days, and the mixing is just stirring it up. The mixing is very substantial. And in fact, the mixing that occurs on day four that happened, and this is from their records, on January 15th.
Are you reading from something that
so
we can
I'm
look at?
So I'm actually reading from a trial exhibit that's not in the appendix. I can, however, hand it over, obviously, to counsel and to Mr.
Just
Green.
What's the number?
So it's plaintiff's trial exhibit number 98, and I can provide copies of that.
Will that be on PACER, or is it got a lot of yellow markings on it?
It won't be. It's a summary exhibit that's based on their confidential information. So,
okay. Can you submit it and confer with counsel on the other side about whether appropriate completeness of submissions is satisfied? No, I don't mean right now. I mean afterwards.
But what happened is, so that the 100 kilogram vat was mixed for 20 minutes at 820 RPMs. This is very violent mixing. And that's what the testimony was saying, that this type of mixing is exactly what can cause the conversion. The other issue is that...
Which sample was that?
This was between the day one and the day four for the 16001.
This is 100 minutes?
This is what was 20 minutes at 140 RPMs.
800 something.
800, I'm sorry, 840. That's right.
And this was, do I understand it from Mr. Maloro, this would have been basically just before the samples were drawn.
Exactly.
Okay.
And the other point that was raised is this idea that somehow Merck should have, and I think Judge Clevenger referred to this as an illusory.
When did you learn that? So you knew about this early on. You could have replicated that in your own lab.
I'm glad you mentioned that because that's about what I was getting ready to go to. We actually can't replicate their industrial process. For one, we didn't have 100 kilograms of the material. For another matter, it matters a lot in this, exactly, for example, the shape, the material of the container, the shape of the impaler that does the agitation. All of this matters. There are chemical engineers that spend their lives to make sure these processes are specifically precise. For example, when the FDA approves a product to come out of a certain facility, you can't change a little piece of equipment without getting approval. And that's exactly because these processes change. You can't just do them in somebody else's equipment with other materials in a different place. And in fact, there's unrebutted testimony on this from Merck's chemical engineer expert, professor at MIT, who works with manufacturing processes at pharmaceutical plants. And it's on appendix page
two. So your view is that her invitation to you to do this testing was a trap for the unwary.
I think when you said illusory is exactly correct. There was the fact that she found we actually proved that additional mixing causes it is a great result, and we really can't have anything more than that because there's no way we can actually recreate what they do in their plant with their machines. And that's the exact problem. We could try to take all this stuff. And by the way, you're exactly right. Had we done it, and it would have been correct. It would have criticized every little thing we did. It would have led to another...
Well, I don't think she was requiring proof. She was requiring what I would call a prima facie case that you would have made. That she would have said, okay, you convinced me that day four might make a difference. Therefore, give it over and let you test.
And this is where it's, I think, a little bit bizarre reading the opinion because... She did find that the additional mixing tends to cause conversion, but she found it wasn't specific enough. Well, it
can't. You said your arguments are theoretical.
Yeah.
By the time she got to hear you, having given you an invitation that she thought was to let you come up with something scientific, you didn't come up with something hard science, so she said you're theoretical. Well,
this was scientific. By the way, if we had tried to reproduce the entire process, which is pretty much impossible somewhere else, that would still be theoretical. Because everything in that process would not match what happened to the actual product in this case, what happens to the product as it's being made in their plant.
It seems to me what Emil would say is that would not constitute proof of the final fact, but it would be possibly, as Judge Clevenger said, a pretty suggestive prima facie case that it was worth looking at the actual difference between 4 and 1, and that you could have done stuff to do that, to reach that level, which you didn't do.
Well, keep in mind, we're talking about recreating...
I mean stuff in a most precise sense.
We're talking about recreating an industrial process. So finding a plant that can be done, this is not something that you just undertake willy-nilly. We're not talking about just shaking the bottle, because that doesn't recreate their process. We're talking about running an entire industrial process in a plant, which wouldn't be their plant. And I don't think, by the way, they would agree that that actually proved anything, because they would say, that's not the product. We don't know.
Well, did you? But this is interesting, but you didn't make this showing to Judge Robinson. You didn't come up and say at the trial, you know, you made this invitation to us, Judge, and we thought that was a really nice thing for you to do. And we went back, and guess what?
Actually,
we've got all these problems.
Actually, we did. And our expert described exactly to her why that's not possible, and it's on appendix page 202. This is unrebutted testimony, and that's on appendix page 202, and it's on page the testimony on pages.
What's he saying on 202? This is trap, right?
So the question is at the toward the bottom of page 207. And why did you not design any experiments to confirm your opinions? And then he provides a lengthy answer. Okay, well, first of all, my opinion is that increased mixing, it's vigorous mixing significantly, causes conversion. And he goes on to describe exactly that reproducing an industrial process is not something that's feasible.
Where does he say that? Does the word line what? Page 208?
208,
page
6.
208.
Right, but there's a substantial gap between couldn't reproduce the industrial process and couldn't produce, couldn't undertake a variety of experiments that would tend to be suggestive, would point in a direction that would tell you we really do have to have the actual sample.
Keep in mind that we're talking literally as trial is coming up, and the simplest thing, frankly, would have been...
No, that's right, but by the time this came up, the simplest thing was no longer an option because they didn't do what they should have done in January.
And that's the point that I think, though, matters.
And then Judge Robinson had to deal with that.
That's correct, and sometimes, as you know, trial judges get laser beam focused on trial dates, and I think in the end that's what happened here. But what we can't have is, I think, something that says in a Hatch-Waxman case, it's okay for the generic to withhold what's the final product that should actually be tested, and somehow then that we end up testing an intermediate, which I do believe the law of this circuit is that shouldn't be what the infringement opinion, the decision is based on. And then what we end up with is a Hatch-Waxman case that kind of becomes meaningless, even though it's still, at this point, very important. Because, for example, let's say in two months we test...
I have a feeling that we're going around in circles now, and we've been well over 5 minutes, unless you think you actually have something new to tell me.
The only thing I'll say is that we just asked for a remand and the actual samples of the ANDA product for testing for the Hatch-Waxman case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks to both counsel. It's been very instructive.
All right.